Pam and I were out walking in the neighborhood yesterday, late yesterday afternoon. We bumped into a neighbor, and after chatting for a few minutes, the neighbor said, "Hey, weren't you looking for Georgia-Auburn tickets a while back?" And I said, "Yeah, before the season started." That game has taken on a very different look 2 months into the season, hasn't it? Now, it's not the same game anymore. Both Auburn and Georgia won yesterday, but the truth is neither one of them is very good. And this season has been lost, at least as far as championship hopes of any kind go. And so Georgia and Auburn fans can commiserate with each other when we play and find out who's the best of the worst. You know, Alabama fans, you know, well, Alabama's Alabama. And so you guys still have hope. You still have the possibility of, to borrow a phrase from Mark Richt, to finish the drill. To finish the drill. You have that possibility of finishing the drill. I'm not sure Mark Richt is going to finish the drill, but Alabama has the possibility of finishing the drill. And I want to borrow that phrase this morning for the title of my sermon. It is mistitled here. I forgot to change it from last week. The title of this message is not "The Fruit of Faith," but "Finish the Drill." Finish the drill. Because that's essentially what the preacher of the Hebrews church is doing in chapter 12. In chapter 12 of Hebrews, he is essentially saying to them, "Finish the drill." Only here, it's not a motivational tool for winning a football game. It is the inspiration to live by faith no matter what, even in the face of death. Even in the face of death. You'll remember that in chapters 11, he had demonstrated what it means to live by faith, and he pointed to the lives of those who had gone before them, both the famous and the anonymous, who demonstrated in their very lives what it looks like to live by faith. Through their lives, he helped us to understand that sometimes living by faith means victory of a promise fulfilled. There certainly are those times when God calls us to stand by faith, and the fruit of that faith is a victory because of the faith that we stood in for that promise. But he also helped us to see that sometimes faith results in the willingness and the ability to endure until the promise is fulfilled at some point in the future, sometimes even beyond the grave. So faith sometimes looks like victory, sometimes it looks like endurance. And this small house church had experienced both of them. I mean, the truth is, the members of this church had actually received the promise that all of those the preacher was talking about in chapter 11 were waiting for. They all died having not yet received the promise of the Messiah. But these believers had actually received that promise. They were recipient. I mean, all of those who went before them were longing for and waiting for and enduring for the promise that they had now received. So in one sense, they had the victory. But in another sense, they were not unlike those examples of chapter 11, because they now were having to endure as they awaited the fulfillment of the ultimate promise of Christ's return. So they had received the victory, but they were also having to stand and endure. And so the preacher uses a metaphor that they would have understood very well. It's a metaphor of an athletic contest inside of a magnificent arena. In fact, it's interesting, it's not a huge point, but it's interesting that this Colosseum was being built probably within a few miles of this house church when this message came to them. This was a society that understood athletics. It had a great appreciation for athletics. They were inspired by athletes. And so he uses that metaphor to encourage him to finish the drill, to finish the drill. So look with me, first of all, at Hebrews 12, 1 through 3. "Therefore, Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. So that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Now, the image is of a great stadium that is filled with people. But I want you to notice, they are not spectators, they are witnesses. It's a very different thing. These are not spectators, but witnesses. The truth is, our great stadiums on pretty much any given Saturday or Sunday are filled with spectators. Our stands are filled with people, most of whom haven't even played the game. They're there to be entertained. That's what spectators do. They go to be entertained, or perhaps they go to taste a little bit of glory vicariously through a bunch of 18 to 21-year-old kids. That's what our stadiums are filled with. This stadium, the stadium that the preacher imagines, is a stadium that is filled not with spectators, but with witnesses. What does that mean? It is filled with champions. It's filled with people who have already run the race. They have already finished the race. And they have already received the crown, the victor's crown of glory. That's who is sitting in these stands. And so, without a question, they were cheering. But they weren't cheering as those who were, you know, hoping to be entertained or to somehow meet their own needs. They were cheering as those who had already run the race, and they were there to encourage those who were still in the race, those who were on the field, that by our lives you can see the race can be won. The race can be won. They wanted them to see that. And in this case, this is one of those rare cases where every runner had the opportunity to win. It's not going to be one runner, but everyone who finished the race would receive the victor's crown. So they are there to be witnesses. And this is what he says. I want you to look at their lives, to look at the stories that he just told in chapter 11. And he said, this is what I want you to draw from their testimony, from the testimony of their lives. He says, first of all, throw off everything that hinders. Throw off everything that hinders. What is he talking about there? Some say that he was talking about throwing off their clothing. In those days, some of you may know this already, but athletes in those days didn't wear clothing. They saw clothing as something that got in the way, that slowed them down. And so they were literally throwing off their clothes so that they could run unhindered. Some say, and this is, there's certainly some truth to this, that athletes, even in those days, just as we do today, often trained with extra weight. You've seen batters in baseball, when they're warming up and getting ready to bat, they'll put a lead sleeve on the end of their bat to give it extra weight so that by the time they get to the plate, the bat feels light and they can swing it faster. That's the kind of thing that he's talking about. These athletes would sometimes put on extra weight so that when they ran, it would push them to train harder. So then when they took the weight off, they could run even more freely. Either way, what he's talking about here is putting off. When the time comes to actually run the race, you don't want that extra weight. It's good for training, but it's not good for running the race. So he says, get rid of the extra weight. By the way, notice here that throwing off that which hinders is not talking about things that are necessarily bad. They may be good things. They may be things that have great benefit, but he says, if they slow you down in the race, throw them off so that you will not be delayed. Secondly, he says, throw off the sin that entangles. Now, we know the first thing was not sin, because now he is talking about sin. There are some things that are inherently bad. There's some things that aren't bad, but they still may slow you down. But then there are things, there are sins that actually will do more than slow you down. They will entangle you. They will entangle you and they may cause you to fall. They may cause you to trip and to fall down. And so he says here, don't compromise with sin. Don't let sin into this picture so that it ends up slowing you down to the point of even falling or being or failing to complete the race. Don't let sin entangle you. And then thirdly, he says, run with perseverance. Run with perseverance. What is he really saying there? He does not say run as fast as you can. That's what you do when you sprint. When you run a marathon, you don't start by running as fast as you can. You run recognizing this is going to be a long race, and I need to start in a way that I can maintain for the long haul. It's very clear that he's saying to these believers in Rome, the Christian life is a marathon. It's not a sprint. It is not a sprint to the finish. It is a marathon of endurance. So don't be surprised when the promise is delayed. Don't be surprised when you can't see the finish line quickly. Determine at the very beginning of the race to run all the way to the end, to endure to the very end a very long race. And then he says, fix your eyes on Jesus. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Whether you can actually see the finish line or you can envision it in your eyes, those who compete, compete with their eyes on the prize. And here, Jesus himself is the prize. He says, fix your eyes on Jesus. It's so important when we're in this race to know what the prize is and to keep our eyes firmly fixed there all the time. It's interesting, I will say this as well. I love, it's a beautiful thing to me, that he says, fix your eyes on Jesus. Not the Lord or Jesus Christ. If you look through the book of Hebrews carefully, do you know when he uses the word Jesus all by itself? When he's wanting to emphasize his humanity. When he wants to emphasize his humanity. So he's saying, fix your eyes on the man, going back to what he has said in Hebrews 4:15-16. Fix your eyes on the one who has already been there and done that. Fix your eyes on the one who understands the race you're now running. Who knows what it's like to run this race, who has been there himself. Fix your eyes on Jesus because he's been there. He can help you and give you what you need in the moment to finish the race. We have to keep our eyes fixed. To fix your eyes means you don't look to the right or the left. If you don't look, you don't get distracted by, you're running with blinders on. You want to make sure that you're always looking straight ahead. There was a very famous race in the 1950s. It was actually called the Miracle Mile. It was run by Roger Bannister and John Landy. Roger Bannister, I think most of you probably know this, was the first man to break the 4-minute mile. Within weeks, John Landy not only broke the 4-minute mile, but broke his record. And a few months later, they had what was to be the foot race of all foot races. Bannister and Landy running together against each other. The two people who had, for the first time in history, broken a 4-minute mile, they're now running against each other. As they were running, Landy got out ahead. And he maintained that lead for most of the race. In fact, when they turned down the final stretch, Landy actually increased his lead a bit going down the final stretch. But at one point near the end of the race, Landy turned and he looked back. What he didn't realize is that Bannister was coming up on his right. And as he was looking back, Bannister passed him, took the lead, and he didn't even know he was behind until a few seconds later when he looked back and realized then that Bannister had passed him. Bannister ended up winning by a few yards. This picture is the moment where Landy lost the race. Landy was to say years later, he said, Lot looked back and was turned into a pillar of stone or salt. He said, I looked back and was turned into a pillar of bronze. There is a bronze statue now that depicts the moment he lost the race. He lost the race the moment he took his eyes off the finish line and looked back. Well, what a powerful image. I mean, what he's saying to us is this. There are going to be so many things in your life that will distract you. So many things that will compete for your attention and for your focus. Not all of them will be bad. Some of them will be good. But don't let anything keep you from keeping your eyes fixed on Jesus. Now he goes on to add to that. He says, consider him. Consider him. Now, the reason I'm treating that differently is it's one thing to fix your eyes on Jesus, but it's another thing to consider him. To consider something means to think deeply about it. It means to meditate on the reality of it. And he's saying, don't just look at Jesus, but consider deeply the meaning and significance of his life. Dwell on this truth. Let this truth stay with you. He has reminded them that Jesus is the author and the perfecter of their faith. The author and perfecter of their faith. What does that mean? That Jesus is the author of their faith means that he is the beginning of faith. And it is in his life that we have the perfect example of what faith looks like. In essence, as the author of their faith, he is the trailblazer. He is the one who has gone first so that the rest could follow. By the way, here's an interesting other side note about that great race. Not so much that race, but Roger Bannister's feat. You know that for decades, people have been trying to break the four-minute mile. And all the doctors and all the people that studied the human body said it's impossible. The human body simply was not made to run that fast. No one will ever break the four-minute mile. Do you know that within, I think, about a year and a half after Bannister broke the four-minute mile, something like 17 people ran a sub-four-minute mile? They needed someone to lead the way. They needed someone to break the barrier so that they would have, that's what a trailblazer does. He blazes the trail so that others can follow. And that's what it means when the preacher here says, Jesus is the author of your faith. He has shown you how to do it. He has shown you that it can be done. But not only that, he is also the perfecter of your faith. That means he will make your faith complete. He's not just your example, but he is the source of the strength that you need to live by faith. That's why he says, consider him. Don't just look at him, but dwell on the deeper significance of who he is and what he has done. In other words, Jesus is not just there to inspire you. That's good. But honestly, inspiration doesn't help a whole lot if you don't have the ability to do it, right? He's there not only to inspire you, but to give you what you need to be able to finish the drill, to be able to finish the race. Jesus is the author and the perfecter of our faith. Now, let me just ask you this morning, how are you doing right now in your race of faith? I mean, just take a minute to kind of do a gut check here. How are you doing right now in your own race of faith? Do you have extra weight that's slowing you down? You become entangled in sin? Are your eyes fixed on the prize, or are you living a life that's just filled with distraction? Are you availing yourself of the inspiration and the resources that only Jesus can give? How are you doing in your race? It's interesting that the preacher doesn't stop here. He continues, and he actually changes the metaphor a bit from an athletic race to parental discipline. But I want you to see what's going on here. Why does he shift, and why does he go on? Because I'm convinced that the reason is he understands that this particular group of believers is having a hard time hearing what he's saying because they are listening to other voices. They are listening to some other voices that are giving them very different messages that is leaving them confused. And so it's hard for them to hear what he's saying. And so he goes on in verse 4 to say this: in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your own blood. Now, I do want to point out here that struggling against sin in this context is not struggling with my own sin, but struggling to deal with the sin that's coming against me. In other words, struggling with the sin and the wickedness of those who are persecuting them and even threatening to destroy them. That's the struggle against sin that he's talking about. The struggle against somebody else's sin. And he says to them, in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your own blood. Now, why is he saying that? I mean, how does that fit with what he just talked about? Here's what I think he's saying. I think he's saying, yes, you've got it pretty bad. You've got it pretty bad, but not as bad as some. Not as bad as some. All those people we talked about in chapter 11, most of them died, suffered, lived without receiving the promise. You've got the promise, and so far you haven't had to give your life yet. You hadn't had to shed your blood for the sake of the gospel. So he says, you've got it bad, but not as bad as some. Now, why would he say that? I mean, honestly, that almost feels like, okay, well, that's, you know, thank you very much. I appreciate you pointing out the fact that not only am I suffering, but I'm bad for even feeling bad about it, right? Because other people have got it worse. I mean, we as parents do this all the time, don't we? I mean, we remind our children how bad the Chinese kids have it, right? This is one of the things we do, and yet there is something very important here. The reason he's reminding them of this is this reason. We have a tendency to think nobody's ever had it as bad as me. We have a tendency to think nobody's ever had it as bad as me. And let me just tell you, that the minute you start listening to that voice, which is clearly the voice of the enemy, if he takes you very far down that road, you will quickly lose your heart, you will lose your hope, and you will give up. That's why there is a consistent theme in God's word that says to us things like this. You've not yet had to do this. Paul says it a different way in the book of 1 Corinthians. He says there, I love this scripture. He says, no temptation has seized you. Temptation is not just to sin, it's also a trial. And you can see it either way. No temptation to sin or no trial has seized you except that which is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. One of the enemy's great weapons against us is to get us consumed with our own suffering and to begin to believe the lie that no one in the history of the world ever had to go through what I'm going through. And as soon as we bite that hook, we are being led down a road that can lead to our destruction. So he reminds them, it's bad. I know it's bad. But what you're going through, you're not the first one to go through it. You're not the first one to go there. Others have been there before you, and they have shown you what it looks like to live by faith, to live by faith. And then he goes on to remind them of a second thing. He says in verses 5-6, and you have forgotten that word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. He reminds them of the role of discipline. I think this is interesting in the flow of the whole chapter. Early on, the call is to discipline ourselves, to discipline our own bodies, to discipline ourselves to run the race, to finish the drill. But he says, you know what? You also have one who is committed to helping you get there. You have one who is committed to helping you finish the drill. And one of the ways that he helps you is through discipline. He quotes Isaiah 35. And it seems that he is addressing an issue that also it can be very common today. And that's this. I think he knows that they're listening to voices that are telling them, God has forgotten you. Or even worse, God has abandoned you. God doesn't see what you're going through, or God doesn't care about what you're going through. This is another of the enemy's great strategies, is he can convince us that God is asleep at the wheel, or worse, that God doesn't care, then very quickly we'll lose our hearts and we will give up. And he reminds them that the exact opposite is true. that God allows you as his children to go through hard things in order to make you strong for the whole race. He disciplines you so that you will not give up quickly. He lets you go through hard things so that you will be steeled for the long haul, so that you will not be fragile, spoiled children who give up at the least bit of resistance. You see what he's saying here? He says, we have a father who is totally and completely dedicated to helping us run the whole race to the very end. Our God will not let us be those spoiled, fragile children. He's going to do everything to strengthen us for the long haul. Listen to what he says in verses 7 through 11. And I'm going to read this from the Message because I just love the way Peterson paraphrases it. He says, this trouble you're in is not punishment, it's training. It's not punishment, it's training. The normal experience of children. Only irresponsible parents leave children to fend for themselves. Would you prefer an irresponsible God? We respect our own parents for training and not spoiling us. So why not embrace God's training so we can truly live? While we were children, our parents did what seemed best to them. But God is doing what is best for us, training us to live God's holy best. At the time, discipline is not much fun. It always feels like it's going against the grain. Later, of course, it pays off handsomely, for it's the well-trained who find themselves mature in their relationship with God. He does three things here that I just want to point out very briefly. The first thing is that he tells us or helps us to understand the necessity of discipline. The necessity of discipline. We cannot and we will not grow strong and mature unless we are left to face and to work through hard things. I mean, that's one of the basic principles of life. It's like God has built it into to our very system. You know, God is committed to making us strong. Now, quite frankly, we live in a day where discipline is a bit of a dirty word. I mean, just even talking about discipline of any kind seems to get a reaction. Derek and I were just talking this week about a local coach who just a couple of years ago was still paddling his players if they got out of line. And, you know, and of course, we started reminiscing about the fact that we got paddled all the time. I mean, it wasn't even a question about it. I mean, that was just the way things were done back then. And it's almost like our, you know, certainly those kind of things can, corporal punishment can certainly be abused. But it's almost like we have gone to the complete opposite extreme and thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And to devastating effect. So many of our kids today have no idea what discipline is. Have no idea why they need to experience the consequences of their actions and not be rescued from it in order to grow and become strong. Discipline is a necessary part of the maturing process. I can tell you that my dad did a pretty good job of this. I don't mean that he beat me all the time, because he didn't. I mean, the truth is he would spank me or give me a whipping if I needed it. So we were quoting Jeff Foxworthy. You probably heard this, but Foxworthy said, you know, everybody talks today about time out. He said, my dad took time out of his busy day to whip my behind. I mean, that's the only kind of time out I knew about. And that's true, isn't it? I mean, we lived in those days. And I got to be honest with you, it wasn't fun at the time. I look back and I see that he was teaching me something very important. Helping me to remember the consequences. I can remember my dad just choosing not to rescue me from the consequences of my actions, but allowing me to go through it, not because he hated me, not because he was mad at me, because he loved me and he knew that if I didn't have to live with the consequences, I would never learn and grow to the point of taking responsibility for my own actions. He knew that. And so he let me suffer the consequences of my actions. I remember a young freshman playing football, and you know, I'd signed up to play, and it was way harder than I thought it was going to be. And there was a point where I really wanted to give up, and my dad said, "Now I didn't force you to do this. I didn't tell you you had to do it. You decided to do it and you made a commitment. And you're going to keep your commitment. And you know what happened as a result? I mean, it was hard. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. But you know what it did? Helped me to see that I was capable of more than I ever imagined. Because the coaches pushed us beyond what we thought we could do. It was hard, but it was good. I can remember when I started complaining that I was kind of tired of driving the family car. And my dad said, well, son, you can have any car you want, as long as you can pay for it. He said, you get, you know, whatever you want, you get. I mean, I had to buy my first car. And you know, at the time I didn't like that. I wish he'd just given it to me. But he says, you need to have skin in the game. You need to take ownership of it. Now I will tell you, this isn't part of the sermon. This is probably a little bit of old bitterness coming out, but, there was a double standard. My sister got a car. You know, I've never quite figured that one out. And I have to say, she turned out really well. So if there's somebody here that's already bought your kid a car, don't hear me saying that you've ruined them for life. But he did. I mean, he said, if you want a car, you're going to buy it. And so I bought my first car. When I went off to college, he sat me down. He said, now, we're going to help you. We're gonna provide a portion of that which you're gonna need to get through college. First of all, it won't go past 4 years, so don't even think about year five or six. You got 4 years, and you're gonna have to work probably 20 hours a week. But if you do that, if you work hard in school and you work 20 hours a week, you'll get out of college and you won't owe a dime. You'll be completely debt free, and you'll be able to move on without that burden. And at the time, I didn't love that plan. You know, I would have preferred a plan that included them just paying for my way. But you know what? I eventually respected him even then. I knew it was the right thing to do. But now, I don't disrespect him. I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for it. Because it demonstrated his love for me. You know why parents don't discipline? One is maybe they don't know how. I mean, let's grant that. Some parents don't discipline because they weren't disciplined. They don't know what discipline looks like. And so I've got a great deal of compassion for parents who simply don't know how to discipline. But there are two other reasons that most parents don't discipline. One is because they're too consumed with their own lives. And disciplining is harder than just letting kids do what they want to do, right? And so they're just too consumed with their own lives to see the need and to give to a child what that child needs to truly thrive. Or they don't care. They simply don't care. Those who love will discipline. Now, granted, you may discipline. There are all different ways of discipline. And please don't hear me saying this is the only way to discipline your children. I'm just giving some examples of how my parents did it for me. But let me just say this. A parent who truly and deeply loves his child or her child, it's going to do everything they can to raise up a mature child. And you know what? You don't get maturity without suffering. You don't get maturity without hard work. You don't get maturity without skin in the game. And so parents who deeply love their children are going to call their children to some hard things because they love them. And you know what he's saying here? He's saying, we get this, right? And the truth is, our parents were flawed. Some of the things that my dad or my mom did were not probably the best thing in the world. They were flawed. But we understand it even in spite of the fact that they were flawed. He's saying, if we can understand it on the human level, then how much more should we understand it when we have a God who will never make a mistake? A God who will never, ever discipline you out of his own insecurities or out of his own fears, or out of his own lack of paying attention, or whatever it may be, but a God who is 100% committed to raising you up to be strong and mature. It's necessary. Secondly, he says this, we need to understand the right response. The right response is not resistance or rebellion, but to submit. To submit. Our children have such a, we had such a hard time understanding this when we were kids, right? We wanted to rebel. We wanted to fight against the discipline. But there comes a point where you realize, okay, this is what's best for me. And we submit. And it is in the submission that we embrace the plan, that we embrace the act that is meant to help us. And the same thing is here with God. We can buck against the goad. We can push against the goads. You know, we can try to get ourselves out of it somehow. But the absolute best way to deal with discipline is simply to submit and to say, Lord, I trust you. To submit to God means I trust that what you are doing is for my good. I trust that what you're allowing is for my good. So I'm no longer going to listen to those voices that keep telling me you don't care, that you've abandoned me. I'm going to trust that you see, and I'm going to trust that you're good, and I'm going to submit to your discipline. And then lastly are the results. And he says the results are going to be holiness, righteousness, and peace. The first result is that God is shaping our character through suffering and through difficulty. Peter talks about it like one who purifies gold by putting it through the fire. As the gold goes into the fire, the impurities are burned off, and what you're left with is pure gold. That's exactly what he's talking about here. That God will allow us to go through trials and difficulties in order to burn off those things which are not good, to burn off those things which will end up hurting us and to make us holy. And the second benefit is righteousness, a right relationship with God, and the ability to live a life of faith in righteousness in a very unrighteous world. And then lastly, there is peace. One of the great benefits of God's discipline is that we come to a place where we are at peace with God. We understand what he's doing and we receive it and accept it. We're at peace within ourselves. We're no longer battling over all these questions and allowing the confusion to keep us churned up, but we've come to a place where we trust God completely and we are at peace. And we're at peace even with each other. And then he says, one more verse I want us to see this morning. He essentially says, when you get to that point where you're ready to give up, and every runner, this is he talking specifically about runners here, every runner will tell you there is that point. There is that point in the race where you are absolutely convinced you can't keep going. Your knees begin to shake, your whole body aches, and you just know, I cannot run another step. He says, in that moment, wait for your second win. Wait for your second win. Again, athletes who have trained know that that happens. There's a point where you feel like you're going to completely collapse, and you push yourself through that point of collapsing, and you discover a second wind, a new burst of energy, a new resolve to keep going, and you find a new strength. I love this passage, especially from the New Living Translation. He said, so take a grip with your tired hands and strengthen your weak knees. Mark out a straight path for your feet so that those who are weak and lame will not fall but become strong. You hear what he's saying here? He's saying, don't feel ashamed if you feel tired. Don't feel guilty if your knees are shaking and your hands feel like you can't hold on anymore. He says, that's normal. That's a part of the race. Don't let the enemy pour guilt and shame on you for that. But here's what you do. You take a new grip. And you straighten your legs and you keep going until you get the second win. It's coming. You're going to get it. The second win is going to be there. But don't give up before you get it. And I'd also want you to see here, don't miss this point. There is some mutual responsibility here. He says to us, don't do this for yourself. But do it in a way that those who are lame, you know, there's some who in the course of running get hurt. And it's not just tired, they're actually hurt, they're wounded. And he says, when you see one who's wounded and hurt, you get beside them and you help them to finish the race. What a beautiful picture, right? And you know, I suspect this morning that we've got people that are all over the map on this issue. There's some of you who have caught your second wind and you've come through a hard time, but you're in a great place right now. There's some of you who are sucking wind. And honestly, right now you feel like you're about to collapse. And the Lord is saying to you this day, don't give up. Don't give up. Finish the drill. Finish the drill. Take a new grip. Strengthen your legs because your second wind is coming. And there are some of us here who are lame. We've been hurt. We've been wounded. And it's our responsibility to come around you. I'm going to ask those who are serving communion right now to go ahead and come and make the elements ready. Because we want to give you time this morning to respond. If you're here today and you simply just need to celebrate what God has done in your life, you need to celebrate the fact that God is good and that you have chosen to trust him. You have chosen to keep running with the promise that he will fulfill that word. Just come, take the bread, dip it in the juice, and celebrate that Jesus Christ is the author and the perfecter of your faith. What a great way to celebrate today, by coming and just thanking him for his sacrifice and receiving it today with new grace. Some of us need to spend some time praying and just asking the Lord for whatever resources you need right now to endure your race. But there may also be some this morning who need some help. You've been hurt and you truly do need help to get through the race. There are people here up front who are ready to pray with you, who are ready to lock arms with you and take you to the Lord, the author and perfecter of your faith, so that you will have what you need. Let me just invite you to stand and let's begin to respond however the Lord leads us to respond.